How do we create network, expand the network, leverage a network, and engage it?
So I always say in networking, the questions you ask are much more important than what you tell them. Do you know the difference between a billionaire and everybody else? They are interviewing you to see how you could get their mission to move forward quicker.
So what could be an advice to start building credibility at an early age?
We can smell inauthenticity. We feel it. It's a natural human instinct to see somebody and go, repel. All we do in Dubai is we focus on the future. There is no past to go back to. The future requires you to do exactly the opposite. It's got nothing to do with a system. It's got to fit into your uniqueness. And your uniqueness is based on your curiosity. The efficiencies is all being taken care of by AI. We don't have to be in the efficiency game anymore. Your brain is so addicted to familiarity that you don't even realize how addicted you are to a life that you might not even like. But if you're not slowly but surely, on a daily basis, engaging with things about the future, engaging with ways to heal your past, engaging with the meditation, engaging with becoming more stretchable in your brain, you're going to become irrelevant, just like the farmers who never wanted to pick up the industrial tool.
Welcome to Reimagining You, the podcast where we explore the power of personal branding, thought leadership, and future-proofing success. I'm your host, Dr. Eli Daher, and each episode, we dive into the journeys of global recognized leaders who have mastered reinvention, influence, and impact. Today, I'm honored to welcome John Sanay, a globally recognized futurist, best-selling author, and thought-after keynote speaker. John's expertise lies in helping leaders unlearn outdated models and embrace forward-thinking strategies to stay ahead in an era of rapid change. So your ability to distill complex future trends into practical, actionable tools has made you a trusted advisor to Fortune 500 companies and a speaker in over 30 countries. And I'm really pleased to have you on the show. But I have a confession to make. I had to prepare for this podcast and I had to really read one of your famous books in 2 days. What's your moonshot? Okay. So I guess my key takeaway, and you can correct me if I understood it right, it's that it is a must to develop future fit mindset by focusing on adaptability, curiosity, and innovation. Because that's what I think differentiates between a knowledge worker A and a knowledge worker B for the future in the era of AI. And we probably talk about that in a moment.
Yes.
So John, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. Welcome to Reimagining You.
Thank you so much. Wonderful to be here with you. And I got to say, you know, it seems like you've reinvented yourself as well, being in this new role, becoming a new author. So congratulations for you for not only having a podcast about this, but actually living it.
Thank you. Thank you. Another revelation I want to tell you, John, is that if you ever rank, I don't know if you rank your engaged followers, and if you look at the most engaged followers, I'd like to think I make it into the top 10.
I would love for you to be in the top 10. I have no idea. I've never ranked anybody. So
yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Maybe they should have a system to rank followers' engagement.
Yeah. Well, thank you for being a super fan. I appreciate that very much.
No, it's seriously, I've learned so much from your post and your insights and the way you engage with the world. And in fact, your perspective on shifting economy, we'll talk a bit more on the economy and the future of work has influenced me deeply. So I included this in my next book, Reimagining You. So
nice. Love the title. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. I want to have your take on the unlearn to relearn, and particularly in the context of my audience.
Yes.
Or our audience, which is, you know, we're looking at executives.
Yeah.
They're still in the job, maybe. Yeah. They are in a comfort trap where they have a title, a nice title on a business card and a company that has a nice name. So that will open doors for them. And they have a lot of perks and a good salary and whatever. And they're always afraid to make the step forward and create their personal brand while they're working and create their voice as well. Because everybody has some knowledge to share, has some value to give back to the world. And they will be driving motivation. They will be embracing the future. They will be preparing themselves and so forth. So what's your take on the unlearning in the context of our audience?
Thank you for the question. I think it's right to the heart of the real challenge that all of us are living with, right? before I unpack the way I see unlearning, let's just understand what learning is. And learning is quite simply highways of thought. And these neurons that wire and fire together throughout our lives from a very young age govern the way we think, the way we act, and the way we feel. Neuroscience is proving to us that we have between 60 and 70,000 thoughts a day, of which 90% are the same as yesterday, meaning that our brains are repetition highways of thought. We've already decided what we think about men, about women, about money, about the weather. All of these things have been preempted into our brains. And so when I say 60 or 70,000 thoughts a day, you've got to realize these are micro decisions that our brains are making based on familiarity. And so when we say unlearning, we're not talking about you losing knowledge. We're not talking about you losing a level of IQ that you're thinking about. It's the incessant type of thinking that determines your perspective and awareness into the world. So your perspective and your awareness into the world governs what you see. And that is really important, because you realize that you cannot solve a problem from the same awareness that created it, as Einstein said. And so what you have is you have highly intellectual people stuck in a band of awareness, only solving problems within their perspective that their highways of thought have created through education, through culture, and through our lives that we've been living. Now, what unlearning means, it means creating new neural pathways. That's all it means, because as you start to create new neural pathways, you diminish and erode your existing ones. And the only way you can really fix a habit that you don't like is by creating a new one, practicing that new one so many times that it becomes the obvious one and overrides the old one. And so unlearning is actually about building new paths of neurons firing and wiring together. And so the next question is, well, then how do you do that? Because the truth is that your brain is so addicted to familiarity that you don't even realize how addicted you are to a life that you might not even like. And that's the that's the crux of it, is that many people are unhappy with many aspects of their lives, where they keep repeating it. Keep having sugar, keep drinking, keep having the affair, keep having whatever it may be. And that's just because of that incessant thinking. Now, many times, our brain's wiring is actually very much determined by trauma that hasn't been healed. And so what happens is that trauma gets so deeply stuck into our subconscious patterning that we create personas based on defensiveness, not exploration. And so what we have is, we have a population at large that's hardly done any therapy, has done hardly any healing of their past and their trauma, and have got almost psychotic, if not OCD, if not addicted to perfection, if not defensive mechanisms that are intertwined into their personalities that they think is quite normal. So there's three ways that I talk about in broad terms to move into the process of unlearning. One of them is healing your past. Whatever trauma that you are carrying from yourself or your family lineage needs to be processed, faced, and healed. Now, there's many modalities. There's family constellation, which is a fantastic modality that doesn't require you to induce yourself in any sort of ayahuasca or mushrooms or any of that sort of deep subconscious work. There's many modalities, but the question you need to be asking yourself is, have I healed my past? Do I have trigger points that keep me stuck in defense of the old world, which means that I'm not unlearning, I'm just protecting. Even though it's an uncomfortable space, I'm still protecting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Number two, are you able to meditate? Because a meditation gives you the ability to calm your nervous system, to look at the pathways that you've created, and then to actively start to create new ones. And three is the opportunity to develop positive future memories. And my new book is called Future Memories, and it's really about the opportunity for us to sit quietly, to rewire our brain actively through the process of visualization, imagination, and meditation, so that you can quite literally start to think about thinking in a brand new way. What all of this leads up to is your ability to change awareness as quickly as possible, unlearning old ways of thinking and acting in brand new ways.
This is fascinating, John. That is, I never looked at unlearning this way. I'll share my own experience on unlearning, but I wanted to follow through. This is why, what drove you to actually set up the series of future memories, active meditation?
That's right. That's right. What I've done is future memories actually came to me in a meditation. I was actually in a meditation in Cancun at Dr. Joe Dispenza, and I came out of the meditation and it was clear to me that the book needs to be called Future Memories. And it was clear to me what I needed to do. And the book is itself is doing one very simple thing. Can you live a life based on where you're going rather than where you've been? Mm. And this is an imperative thing for a human that is going to be evolving into the future. And you realize that many of us are in pattern repetition. We are in memory repetition. We're not actually vision focused. So that's the point of the book. But the practicality of doing that is very difficult. Reading a book is not going to do that for you. You actually have to literally go in and do brain gym. And brain gym is active meditations. Now, most meditations take us to a place of stillness or mindfulness. And I think this is a very powerful place to be, because when you are in that stillness or mindfulness, that level of peace does an incredible amount of good for your nervous system and for your body. In fact, when you are finding that place of peace, your body's healing itself in a dramatic and exponential way without you in the way. And so that's the first step of meditation. But what active meditation does, it takes you to a point of stillness. And from a point of stillness, starts to guide you into the process of actively thinking what your intentions are, what your actions are, what does allowance and surrender look like? What does relief feel like? What does victory feel like? And as you start to imbue yourself with practicing those emotions, what starts to happen is you actively anchor emotions into your brain. And throughout the day, if you start to wobble and go back into an old way of thinking, you've got now an anchor point of your practicing of that emotion. And if you don't have that anchor point, you keep repeating old ways of thinking. So the meditations are there to build, to simplify your ability to understand the process of unlearning, to relearn, to rewire, to prepare for the future.
Wow. Wow. So I think, you know, if I reflect on what you said and I look at my experience in the unlearning, because now it makes more sense, actually, the way I behave, because I come from a corporate world, right? 27 years in one company, finished university, jumped into this company and stayed 27 years, various countries, but it's one school of thought. This is one way of doing things. Now, with the five generations in the workplace, and being over, you know, my age is 60 plus, right? So trying to manage and lead five generations, particularly the youngsters, is so difficult.
Very.
Because, you know, they have a different way of thought process, different way of thinking, different way of networking. And trying to impose your ideas on those generations is difficult. And who said that you're always right? Because the idea that has worked 20 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago.
You're most probably wrong.
Exactly.
Actually, the probability is more that you're wrong than right. Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. So I had to humble myself.
Yes.
Coming from that corporate world, a big name company.
Yeah.
And then going to actually work with these. I mean, who is this person who's 30 years old and trying to give me a solution? You know? I am Dr. Eli Daher.
Yeah.
But so I had to humble myself and I had to listen, you know. Listen, take it in and analyze it. And guess what? They had a lot of merit.
Of course.
So that's what I go when I talk to leaders my age or a bit younger and they're seasoned and they're, you know, they're stuck in their own way. Try to unlearn. So unlearning to learn and relearn is a key skill for all, you know, senior executives to embrace. But now you've explained it the scientific way. And it makes all sense because I'm trying to create new neurons to be able to deal with new things rather than stuck with all my memories and my, you know, data that is filled over 30 years of experience, right?
Exactly. Look, I explain, it's gym. It's gym for your brain. Because if you never go to gym or yoga, look what you'll be able to, you become stiff. You wouldn't be able to move. You need some old men that can't bend their back. Guess what? That lack of being able to bend your back is also the lack of you thinking in new ways. Your stubbornness of your brain has created a stubborn body. And so what you want to do is you want to bring flexibility. How do you bring flexibility? Meditation. Meditation is, for me, is for the last 5 years, I cannot tell you how much has changed my life, because you get triggered, you go into meditation, you unwind it, come out, you're fresh again. You get triggered, you go in, you come out, you're fresh again. Now, if you are always getting an opportunity to focus on uplifting emotions and freshen yourself up and then make decisions, guess what happens? You make better decisions, more heart-led decisions. You're just a totally different person.
Fresh-minded.
Yeah. And so people always think like meditation is this lofty idea. You have to go and do it for 60 minutes. No, what I've done is I've built these active meditations starting at 15 minutes, then 30 minutes, then 45 minutes that are active. You're actively thinking about things in brand new ways so that you're continuously busy actually training your brain rather than just looking for stillness, which in itself, like I said, has got much power. But we have to also think about the modern human. Sometimes that's difficult. So actively makes it easier for you.
I love that. Are you going to run any meditation retreats?
I will. Yes. I've got a three-day Ibiza one brewing, which is going to be about psychedelics, AI, meditation, and movement. So I think those are the four sort of most important things that we need to be doing right now. And so, yes, I'm in the process of planning them.
I'll be watching that space.
Thank you so much. We'd love to.
You know, you were talking about Cancun, and whenever you do the live streaming from there, because you did on, I keep on envying you there. Why is he there and I'm?
Look, you know how many people say that to me? They're like, yo, it's on my bucket list. I'm like, well, then forget your bucket list. Just go and apply and go and do it. So,
True.
We should all be there.
True. So let's put it into context of personal branding for those executives. And also the another group of audience that we have is the entrepreneurs that are trying to differentiate. They don't have the credibility or authority to claim what the knowledge workers would claim, but they're still going to find their personal brand. They're still going to be creating some kind of credibility so they can go to investors and and seek more funds. So let's put future memories, the meditation, the unlearning into the perspective of this audience and how can they leverage this to build their own personal brand?
So let's first understand the economies of personal branding and where we are and why it's more important than ever before. In the agricultural era, the most important thing that you could do was have a big, big, big size of land. Why? Because the more you grew, the more money you'd make. It was a simple equation. Size of land, and land was cheap back then. I mean, for 10,000 years, the agricultural era, everybody owned the land. I mean, it was a very different system. But the size of your land was really the most important thing. When we went into the industrial area, it was actually the exact opposite. The smaller your space was, the more efficiency you'd bring, keeping your costs low and maximizing your profits. So the skill went from size of land to skill of efficiency. Okay. But now that AI is starting to arrive, the efficiencies is all being taken care of by AI. We don't have to be in the efficiency game anymore. And so where we are arriving into is moving into the attention economy. And in the attention economy, the more eyeballs you have on you, the more you can make movements, sell, motivate, inspire, shift. And you can see this with all the YouTube and TikTok influencers with millions and millions of followers. They can launch anything from avocados to t-shirts to drinks, and they make millions, multi-millions. True. So if the future is about the attention economy, and what is the attention economy? And why do you need the attention economy to understand the attention economy? Is about attention economy is given to people that are truly unique and authentic. They are not given to people that are inauthentic because we can smell inauthenticity. We feel it. It's a natural human instinct to see somebody and go, repel. And that's usually a lack of authenticity. Now, when you are authentic, you speak from the heart and you are heard from the heart. And when you're unique, nobody's skinning the cat like you're skinning the cat. Now you combine those two, and now you start to develop the attention based on your authenticity and your uniqueness. But here's a bigger play. And the underlying play is that remember that the Industrial Revolution celebrated you for fitting into a system. It celebrated you for what you know. The future requires you to do exactly the opposite. It's got nothing to do with a system. It's got to fit into your uniqueness. And your uniqueness is based on your curiosity. So you have to follow your curiosity to give you the sustenance of research and passion and fascination to create that uniqueness, to create the authenticity, to create the attention. So we realize that fitting into the system, and our kids are still going to school fitting into a system, which is a horrific idea because – the system itself is becoming demonetized, democratized, and disrupted.
Yes.
Now, we all know you can't take your kids out of school because it's illegal. But the truth is that your kids are getting ready for yesterday. They're not getting ready for tomorrow. And the skill of tomorrow requires adaptability. And adaptability is about not what you know, but about how you behave. And so if you are curious, authentic, unique, accessing your genius, you are naturally adaptable and you are naturally garnering attention in the attention economy, vis-a-vis, aka personal brand. So your personal brand is not telling us how amazing and clever you are. Your personal brand is about researching and sharing authentically from the heart and allowing your tribe around the world to find you and that tribe around the world to support you. Just like you will find teachers around the world that you will join their tribes. And so the future looks not like a up and down horizontal, up and down vertical idea. It's about pockets of millions and millions of different pockets clinking into each other and feeding off each other based on this level of fascination and curiosity. So personal brand is not just important, it is essential in a world that's moving forward. But don't kid yourself that essential brand is about you having nice pictures and a nice suit, looking cool on stage and in an office. It's about authenticity. We don't care how clever you are. No offense, it's amazing to be a doctor, but nobody cares because we want you to be authentically talking to us. Authentically connecting with us. And that only comes through you prioritizing your curiosity over your knowledge.
Yes. And especially in the digital, in the era of AI, you know, what differentiates Dr. A to Dr. B or the lawyer A, lawyer B, it's not anymore their knowledge because it's accessible, right? They could put in, you know, all the MRIs that they want for a patient. They can sift through 50,000 MRIs and they got a better diagnostic.
Exactly.
What differentiates them is their uniqueness, how they address the patient, how they could be adaptable and emotionally intelligent so they can have empathy with the patient and also curiosity to understand and feel, right?
Let's remember last thing. Agriculture needed muscles. You needed to work the fields. Industrial needed brains because you needed to fit into a system. AI requires heart. It's a very different muscle that's required.
Very nice.
The currency is changing.
Very nice analogy. So in my book, Reimagining You, I put in a 10-step process to build a personal brand for anybody who wants to go through the steps. And they'll have a great personal brand. And I shamelessly stole some of your knowledge, economy, terminology there. So thank you for that.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Enjoy it.
But so my step number two is about the unique value proposition. It's exactly what you talked about, is the uniqueness of the person. So find your own uniqueness. Find what makes you different. Find you what you have. You know, if I were to describe three things about you, what would be the first three things that come to mind, knowing that person? That's basically characterized the uniqueness.
Yes.
So I'm going to go to step number one, which is the mission. First, I would say, okay, well, let's try to reflect. What is your mission? How do you come up with a mission? While you're still working, what is your ambition? What's your mission? So I want to ask John, how did you come up to become such a great futurist, a speaker, and knowledgeable about that? How did you find your mission? I mean, I'm sure you were an employee back then at some place.
Ellie, I've never been an employee.
Oh, okay. you saw the light earlier, I guess.
I always say I had daddy issues, which means that I can't have anybody telling me what to do. You know, I was a rebel. So yeah, I worked for a corporate for 3 months. I absolutely hated it. Like I hated school. I was terrible at school. I got expelled twice. I was a shocking student. You know, I come from a single mom family and we were always financially challenged. And so entrepreneurship was not a nice to have. It was a must to have pocket money, to wear nice clothes, to go out with my friends. And my mom, bless her soul, was working two jobs, couldn't touch sides, you know. And I come from a generation, and I'm sure you share, that many of our dads weren't emotionally available. And not to their own, there wasn't their fault. It was just, that's kind of what was going on back
then. That's how it is,
That's how it was, you know. And so we had this father that was not involved at all. So my mom had to pick up all the things, which means I had to become the man of the house and I had to start showing. So I don't think I was built for corporate. I think I was built for survival. And so I went through a process of becoming exceptionally successful in my 20s and then losing everything. And bankruptcy at 31 years old really woke me up to the potential of self-development, because I was in such a deep shock and depression because I've lost this house and car and almost lost my identity because my identity was linked to the success that I had. You know, when you in your 20s, I mean, what you are your car, you are your house, you are your, yeah, this is who you are. And when that gets taken away, self-development became a thing. And as I moved more and more into the self-development place and space, I started just describing things to my friends of the way I understood things. And they were all like, wow, that's amazing. We never thought about it like that. And then I was always an early adopter from a very young age. I always found the next brand that was going to be cool. And again, I have no idea why. This is just the way my nose is built and my eyes are built. And so I combined that personal development journey based on my bankruptcy together with my natural instinct of understanding the future. And I started to just tell stories about it and just explain things to my friends initially. I wasn't really even doing anything with it. And eventually more and more people wanted to hear about it. And more people wanted to like engage with me and ask me questions. And so I set up a consultancy out of my bankruptcy just to help businesses see the world in the future differently. And that consultancy grew and I created a presentation in that consultancy called Forever Profitable, which explained to people how to stay forever profitable and not go through the pitfalls that I went through in my 20s, having so much success and becoming then arrogant about it and entitled to it and less curious of the world because I'd already arrived, right? And I often joke that high levels of testosterone and lots of money are the most dangerous mix in the world. You think you're bulletproof. And we see that all around the world. That presentation became the first talk. That first talk became a book. The book became a bestseller. And now we are 12 books and speaking around the world. So it's just kind of right place, right time, right curiosity. And
yeah, very, very intriguing story, actually. Thank you for sharing even personal information. So thank you for sharing that. But one thing that I think is common between you and the previous guest I had is you had a compelling event, which is basically bankruptcy, and then you had to reimagine yourself and recreate yourself.
Yes.
Some others had another compelling event where it drove them to actually take a decision and do that. The issue that I think most executives probably, or most of the audience listening to us, they don't have that compelling event because they're in the comfort. They're having their paycheck, but they have responsibilities, liabilities, families, whatever, right? So I think what we're trying to tell them is, you know, don't wait for that compelling event because you might be too late. And if you wait, you might be, I mean, you know, maybe they'll release you and then you'll be out of the job with nothing. Maybe, you know, you are very unhappy with your job or your the culture of the company or whatever, and you're really hate your job, but you have, you're forced to do it. So it creates some issues on your health and your mental well-being and the family and everything. So treat those signs, maybe the unhappiness, the, you know, wishing or willing to do something different, or you have different ambition, whether it's your passion, whether it's another ambition, as a compelling event. Treat it as important as a compelling event, but don't wait for a disaster compelling event to come and change. So the better, or the earlier you can start building your personal brand, the better you are in the future, right? Do you agree with this?
Look, I think what you also have to realize is what's required of you as a human being to add value in the world is drastically changing. So it doesn't matter where you are and at what position you are, you realize that the very thing that you're doing most probably will not be relevant in the next 2 to 3 years because of agentic thinking and regenerative AI. And regenerative AI is going to replace the people that are highly intelligent doing highly repetitive tasks, which is most executives in the world.
Think about
that. Highly intellectual people solving similar problems every day. I'm a client liaison. I'm looking after corporates. I'm looking after HR. I'm looking after accounts. These are all highly intellectual people doing highly repetitive tasks, which is exactly what agentic thinking is going to change. So look, if you are that intelligent, you realize that intelligence in the future is adaptability. It's not knowledge. And you got to also shift it slowly but surely. You don't have to be too like stressed about it. But if you're not slowly but surely on a daily basis, engaging with things about the future, engaging with ways to heal your past, engaging with the meditation, engaging with becoming more stretchable in your brain, you're going to become irrelevant, just like the farmers who never wanted to pick up their industrial tools. It's exactly the same place we're at the moment. And so, yes, it's very difficult to make changes when you're not in pain. But I would imagine that most executives know what's coming, are most probably not very happy in their jobs, but have just made peace with the fact that this is what it is because I've got a big mortgage. I've got kids at school. And so there's a big sort of pressure on executives to stay in there. And I think the corporates know that. And so it's kind of, it's like an intertwined process. So it's not easy for anybody listening, but realize that the skills that you're bringing to the world today in the next few years literally will not be relevant. Literally, not figuratively. We're not like, I'm not trying to scare you, but just go and look up agentic thinking and see what it can do. It's ridiculous what it can do.
It's scary to see it and think about it for the future.
Yes.
This is fascinating. This is actually, it's a lot of advice that our audience is happy to take and listen to. I want to bring it to the next topic, which is now at early age, you have put in some consulting, you put in some presentation here, they like it. So they start asking for some more. So you built credibility and authority slowly but surely. Here I'm going to address the younger generation that are listening to us, the entrepreneurs. My son started consulting, working for a consulting company, big name, but he couldn't take it like you. 2 years he left and he's doing his own thing. He's 24, right? So these young entrepreneurs, how would they build credibility? I mean, you had a medium of people that believed in you, that listened to you and stuff. So what could be an advice to start building credibility at an early age?
Two things. There's only two things.
Okay.
And this is advice to anybody who's got children listening, because it's the same two things. One, how quickly can you access your genius, your uniqueness, your curiosity, and your fascination? How quickly? And the only way you access those is through exposure. You have to expose yourself to as many different jobs, businesses, careers, startups, subjects, as much as you can. Because what happens to us, Ellie, and I'm sure you remember when we were kids, your parents and your parents' friends had four jobs. There was only the engineer, the doctor, the lawyer.
The lawyers.
And that was it. There was nothing else. And I often joke in the Middle East, you can be four things. You can be a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer, a failure. There's actually no other option for you, right?
And true.
True. Exactly.
And I come from the same culture.
Exactly. The Middle East, the Indians, the Jews.
I'm an engineer. My brother's a doctor. Here you go.
Exactly. And I was a failure because I wasn't any of those in my culture. I'm Iranian. So same culture. So you realize that exposure gets you access to genius. That's first. Again, let's go back to uniqueness. If you're not unique in what you're doing, and look, at 24 years old, your son is still figuring things out. So it's really about the curiosity of what you're looking at, even if you don't like it, but the curiosity towards it, right? That's number one. And also in that, intertwined in that, is a lack of victimhood. Because what victimhood does, it gives you a level of entitlement and a level of strife. You're like, in victimhood, you've got this quiet idea inside your head that the life's so tough, things are so tough. And who's coming to save us? And why is the world against us? And everything's crumbling. And that victimhood is shut down very quickly when you prioritize curiosity, because it just doesn't matter what's going on out there. Your curiosity is your priority. The two is distribution. And this is, again, going back to the attention economy, is how far and widely are you distributing your information that you are finding and researching? Are you distributing it in talks, in books, in podcasts, in videos, in blog posts, in what are you doing? So are you creating products out of it? Are you distributing through Shopify? Are you marketing? Are you digital marketing? So what you've got to realize is that whatever the younger or older generation have to think about is uniqueness and distribution. Now, your son was probably, maybe, I don't know, but that age group is quite comfortable talking in a video and sharing it on TikTok and putting it out there. And the older generation isn't, because we're self-conscious. We think we shouldn't be doing that. Who are we to think this? What are our friends going to think when they see this? Whereas the kids today are quite comfortable. Now you realize there's 6 billion people on the internet. All you have to do is get 0.00001% of them to pay you $1 every quarter, and you're living large for the rest of your life. And so you realize that by distribution of your curiosity, you build thought leadership. That's what it is. Wow. And if you think about what I was curious about 10 years ago, had nothing to do with what my curiosity is today, but I was sharing 10 years ago. On YouTube, I have 400 videos. And when I look at the first ones, all I want to do is hug that little guy on that screen, because he had no idea compared to what I know now, he had zero idea, but he was giving it his all. He was out there. He was pushing it. He was putting his information out there, and 2 views and then 6 views and then 12 views. And then now you move up. Now my biggest video is at 2.5 million views, but it's 400 videos later sharing my curiosity and distributing it. And so this is the thing.
Curious, what a winning formula. What a winning formula. Curiosity and distribution. That basically you addressed my chapter 4 in my book. That's excellent. Yes. So I want to bring it now that you have defined a mission, you have looked at your uniqueness, you have created your own voice, you established your credibility, and you've tried to, you know, go out and do the curiosity and be exposed and do the distribution of your curiosity. Now let's talk about the network. So a corporate person goes to trade shows, conferences, they exchange business cards, and they have basically, they think that they're expanding their network. So customers, acquaintances, and colleagues. But this is not the definition of network, because you need to categorize this network. You need to engage the network, and you're great in engaging network. I'm one of them. So what could we talk about? How do we create network, expand the network, leverage a network, and engage it?
Yeah, great question. I think what you've just explained is the physical aspect of creating a network. What about creating a network online? And I think what you create online is access to more people. And we are living in the attention economy that's created something called parasocial relationships. Do you know what they are? One-sided friendships.
Okay.
And so you saw me at Kite Beach. I don't know who you were, but you felt pretty familiar with me. You could have come up to me and you could have high-fived me and I would have no idea who you were. But for you, I was a parasocial relationship friend. And we have these with everybody we listen to. So whoever, Joe Rogan. I mean, if I see a Joe Rogan now, I'd be like, hey, you know that time you spoke about that thing and you know that t-shirt you're wearing there? I'm friends with him, but he's not friends with me. And so I think networking has got this new parasocial relationship angle. But I also think the second thing about networking is that it's like dating a woman. Be patient. Go slowly. You don't need to take it to bed the first night. That's the thing with networking. It's like, what do you do? What do I do? What do I do? What do you do? What do I do? This is how I can do. No. Relax. Just relax. Ask some questions. Just get to know them. And you know, I have been on 3 courses called Thinking Environment or Time to Think. And it's by a lady called Nancy Klein. And she developed the system to give boardrooms the opportunity for everybody to talk. Mm-hmm. It's a process that says everybody on the boardroom table must have 3 minutes to talk. And everybody else on the boardroom must look at that person and be warm in the engagement of it. And what you do is you unpack what's going on inside them. So I always say in networking, the questions you ask are much more important than what you tell them. Because you also want to understand how you're going to work with them in your life. When you go out blurting who you are all the time, you're not strategically thinking how you could work with them in your life. You're trying to hope that they will see you as somebody they could work with in their lives, which is exactly opposite of what a billionaire does. Every time I've met a billionaire, do you know the difference between a billionaire and everybody else? They are interviewing you to see how you could get their mission to move forward quicker. They're not doing the other way. When you come blabbing who you are, what you've done, how you've done it, you're actually making yourself a junior in the discussion. Mm. When I am a custodian or a host of the conversation, I am the boss. My power dynamic is better than yours. By me asking you questions in a patient specific way, I'm checking you out, which makes me the boss. When you are blabbing everything about you, the power dynamics are with me. They're not with you. So when you're networking, be very, very clear that you want to play a long-term game and that online allows you to build friendships with thousands, if not millions of people that you can influence and inspire.
Wow. One thing that I want to comment on, and I want to ask your opinion and advice on this, because if you start asking questions and you ask them in a provocative way, it becomes too inquisitive and becomes probably, some people take it that, why is he asking me all these questions? Maybe there are certain ways of asking the questions, putting it into a dialogue or a discussion.
I call it the architecture of upward spiral conversations.
Okay.
So what I mean by that, and look, Ellie, you don't know me socially, but most of my friends and anybody that I meet, when they leave me, I often get a message afterwards and saying, I feel so inspired. Thank you so much. I feel more energized. And all I've done in that engagement with them is ask them questions of what their potential is for the future. But I've done it quietly. So where do you see yourself next? Like, what are you up to now? Why did you arrive at this? Okay. And what would be that? Have you seen this? They are doing something. All I'm doing is I'm sharing with you a higher potential of who you think you are and how you can achieve where you're going. That'll never be provocative. Absolutely. That'll never be too personal.
Because it's about them.
It's about them.
You're helping their potential. Absolutely.
It's their potential. And then bringing stories in of things that I've seen around them. Never once telling them what I do. Never once telling them I've written so many books. Never once. Because what am I trying to do? Is I'm trying to inspire them to build that rapport and network. And every time they think of me, what do you think they're going to think of me? That was a nice guy. There you go. That's a powerful network.
Yes.
That's somebody. You know, I always joke about this. You know, in a nightclub, there's always a beautiful woman. And there's always 15 guys waiting to take her home. Don't be one of the 15. You'll never have the right power dynamics. That network's a terrible network. Be somebody that inspires her. Be inspired as somebody that hosts the conversation. Be a custodian of the conversation. And when you do that, you build long-term networks that are patient and much richer and much more in depth.
Very nice. I mean, I learned this is very fascinating for me, because what you reflect on the questions to address to your network is about them, is about elevating them, is about helping them. So what differentiates the question I had, which is being a bit provocative or being a bit intrusive, is when you ask the questions that are really you're trying to fish for something for you.
Ah, exactly.
Right? So it's not what, okay, I'm trying to, because I see it in a lot of, you know, social events or social gathering. Yeah. Somebody comes to me and says, okay, what do you do? What do you, you know, what is your job? And so they're trying to understand how can they benefit from you rather than helping you or elevating you, right?
But yes, of course, you're trying to find out what you can do for them, but you do it with potential, not existing. I did this video many years ago about why the CV is outdated. The CV tells me what you've done, not what you're going to do. I want to know what you're going to do. Your CV should be 10% what you've done and 90% what you want to do. And so then what I can do is if I am going to hire you, I'm like, okay, you've said these things. Okay, I'm with you on these things. Let's go. Because your past might not be relevant, but your future might be. And then I can hold you accountable.
So and we should change the whole HR recruiting process, right? I mean,
tell me where you're going.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And this is, should be now the new HR recruiting dynamic.
Exactly.
Absolutely. I subscribe to that.
Yeah. Good.
Three lessons of your life, two or three, whatever you want to share with us, that has impacted you as a lesson while you're in that journey. And then last question is an advice, the final advice to my audience or to our audience.
Jeez, I don't know about three lessons, but I can just tell you one that really caught me off guard. Yeah, one that caught me off guard is I started my second book with this line, and it is, are you running away from the darkness or are you running towards the light? And just think about that. When somebody's running, they're running. They're goal-focused. They are ambitious. They are moving through the world, networking, doing whatever, you know? But one is motivated by anxiousness and one is motivated by excitement. When you are running away from something, you most probably don't even know you're running away from it. But you have got this continuous impatience, anxiousness, frustration, mistrusting, just this combative energy. You think the world's out to get you in many ways. And then you get the other person that is also running next to you, but is excited about what they're building and where they're going. And what usually keeps us running away from something is unhealed trauma that you don't want to deal with. And what gets you excited about moving something forward is that you have no past. Now, the best analogy I can give you is Dubai. The amazing, amazing thing about Dubai, it has no past. It doesn't really have a deep history. There is no blood on this land. There is no apartheid. There is no slavery. There is no misogyny. There's none of that. All we do in Dubai is we focus on the future. There is no past to go back to. And so if you think about that in your personal lives, is the people that had great upbringings that have healed their past are really exploring and excited about where they're going. The people who haven't or are still running in the same race, but are doing it from a very different angle. Now, I remember in my businesses in my 20s, I used to often tell my friends, my colleagues, my partners, my clients, is that I'm so successful because I don't ever want to be poor again. I used to say that over and over, not realizing what I was doing. I never ever said I want to be wealthy. I never ever said I want to be successful. I always said I never want to be poor again because I remember being poor. I remember the trauma and the embarrassment and the shame in front of my school friends when I didn't have pocket money, when I didn't have food. I didn't, like, those things were very shameful to me. And I made a big, big commitment that I never want to be like that again. But I never made a commitment that I want to be rich. And so what happened is I went bankrupt. Why? Because whatever you're running away from is going to catch you. Because it's going to ultimately catch you, because that's what all trauma does. It always eventually catches you. And so it can show up as a sickness. It can show up as a divorce. It can show up as a bankruptcy. It can show up as whatever it may be. But that is a pattern that you haven't dealt with. And so the biggest lesson that I got is your internal dialogue that you're able to sustain within yourself, about yourself, to yourself. And if you are running away, your internal dialogue is continuously telling you how shit you are, telling you continuously that you're not fast enough, big enough, rich enough, good looking enough. And that voice inside your head is going to bring you to demise. And what it does, it brings you towards something called miserable success. And most people that I meet that are super, super wealthy are suffering from miserable success, because miserable success is determined by you running away from something, not building something. And you think that by achieving that Rolls Royce and that figure, seven figure salary or business, you think that's going to bring you joy. And you arrive there and you celebrate for 14 minutes and have a bottle of champagne, and you're straight back to being miserably successful. So ultimately, your internal dialogue that allows you to move towards something rather than away from something, that small change, which is dramatic in the way you approach your life, is by far the biggest lesson I've ever learned. And that's why I'm even writing Future Memories, because all I want you to do is make decisions about where you're going, not where you've been. That just snaps everything out.
Very powerful. Very powerful. So always think about running to the light, right?
To the light, not away from the darkness. Yeah.
Exactly. Not away from the darkness.
Yes.
Well, with this powerful statement, we're probably going to close. Any last word of advice for our audience?
Remember that complexity is the enemy of execution. If something is too complex, you won't execute on it. If the future is too complex for you and you've been ignoring it for too long, it's getting too detailed for you. So what I always suggest to everybody is simplify the future. Expose yourself to it more often. Listen to podcasts. Don't listen to the radio. Listen to things that are helping you evolve your knowledge, your wisdom, your understanding of the future. The more you simplify it, the more you can engage with it. The more you can engage with it, the more you can be adaptable to it. So always expose and simplify on a continuous basis, and that allows you elevation. That's what I'm doing. So that's all I can advise.
John, this is fascinating, and this is very powerful. I really enjoy the podcast, and I'm sure our audience will unpack it and decipher it and then put it into practice. And I think one key message that I learned from you, don't wait, just action it, right?
Action it. Absolutely. Action. Just like you've done. Just like you've done. So congratulations to you. Are you doing a pod? This is not an easy process. You know, you've come up with a name, you've set it up, you've posted it. Like, it's a big process. So well done.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you for accepting our invitation to the podcast.
My pleasure. Next time on Kite Beach, say hi. Hey,
here we go. I will. Ciao. But you're a fast runner, so I'm not going to be able to catch up with you. So thanks for listening to Reimagining You. If you enjoyed the episode, follow the show, leave a review, and share it forward. See you next week with a new episode. Keep reimagining you.